Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
We're going to do a radio show here. This is the Media Project, of course, as you can tell by hearing Pete Seeger's music at the top. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with investigative journalist Rosemary Armeo, who's professor at the University of Albany. Howdy, Rosemary.
Hello.
And Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio, columnist, commentator, the guy who was our host here, who's just made me a nice cup of coffee. What a guy.
My job.
Me too. He must be really going to attack us today.
He's being nice. It's like fattening up the pig, you know, before the slaughter. But we have a lot of issues to talk about. One of them actually is going on in where we sit here in Albany, New York, our neighboring state of Massachusetts, where there is legislation in the Massachusetts House, approved actually by the Massachusetts House. It's a domestic violence bill, but here's one part that's significant. It would keep reports of rape, sexual assault, and domestic violence off the daily police incident logs in order to protect victims. Discuss, class.
I'm always amazed by people, legislators in particular, who think that secrecy is the way you protect people. This bill would make rape almost unreportable. And as the reporters, as the journalists in that state point out, it doesn't protect the victims so much as it protects the perpetrators. You can get away with it. Your name will not be damaged. You will never be held accountable in the public. The other thing is, why is it needed? I know of no newspapers that actually do print the names of sex crime victims. In fact, I've always argued that we ought to, which mm-hmm. is a controversial stance.
But just a little paragraph on why we ought to.
Why we ought to?
Yeah.
Well, because we print the names of every other victim. A victim has done nothing wrong. A victim has sympathy. They should have justice. So why do we act like they ought to be ashamed? We kind of continue the myth that they bring it on themselves. So I've always said, yes, you should print their names. At the very least, we should ask the women if they want their names printed or not. Many do. If I were raped, I want my name and that guy's name all over them.
You know, intellectually, I agree with you. But as the editor of the paper, I don't do it because I think putting the name in there, in most cases, most of the women don't want to have their name out there.
That's changing, Rex.
Yeah,
but you're right.
You're right. Yeah.
You're right.
Mm-hmm.
And I do agree that it has to be handled in a sensitive way. But we don't even ask now. The policy is if the woman says, "I want that guy's name in there," we still don't put it in.
But it's still a cultural shame that we experience in this country. It's terrible that somebody who has been raped is somehow
seen as part of it.
Yes,
they brought it on themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
And by hiding their names, don't we perpetuate
that
idea?
I think we do.
But this law goes even further. It would just keep everything secret. The truth is that now in New York, for example, you can find the names of the victim and the suspect, as indeed you should. They are going to go into a public court of law. This
Absolutely.
Is all information that should be public.
Mm-hmm. The notion that you should conceal information in order to protect people, as you say, is an antiquated one. But you know what happens is oftentimes these police logs, I hate to say this, get doctored by
the
law enforcement authorities. I mean, it used to be...
You mean to protect people?
Yeah, actually. I mean,
so-called.
They don't like reporters,
so-called.
And they think they're doing a good thing. And yeah, you'll see it happens a lot.
Do you think that's true, guys, that police people just don't like reporters?
Generally, I think they believe that reporters are their enemies. They're out to get them. And, you know, we report about police misconduct. And so even the good cops think, you know, why do you have to do that?
Police brutality,
us all down.
Mm-hmm. Abuse of overtime... are huge stories that newspapers and other outlets have done for years. So
that said, without the collaboration of police as sources, we often wouldn't know a lot about stuff. I mean, if you're a cops reporter, you have cops who talk to you, if you're halfway decent even, cops who will tell you on background what's going on, because it serves their purpose. And oftentimes, one of the dangers that we get into as journalists is that we take too much of a police line. We get too much pro-prosecution, pro-cops information into the paper, and we fail to really give adequate coverage to the defense.
Rexon Rosemary, you know, I was recently writing a piece about the George Washington Bridge fiasco and Chris Christie, and I talked to somebody from a major governmental official's office, let's just say in New York, and those folks are often complaining to me that I don't come to them and ask them for their views in a column. Columns are different than news stories. So in this case, I was talking to my source, and I said to him, hey, can you find me the guy who knows the most about George Washington Bridge? And he said, sure. And they come back to me, and then they say to
Chris
me,
Chris Christie, right?
No, this is actually on the New York side. You know, there's been great coverage on the New Jersey side, but very little said about what's going on on the New York side. And remember that New York and New Jersey have to run this PA, Port Authority, together. Mm-hmm. So they said to me, they called me back finally after having complained that I don't ask them enough. And they said, well, yeah, but here's the thing. It would have to be on deep background, number one. And number two, you couldn't quote us. You know, I mean, there would be no quotation. So I said, no, thank you.
Yeah.
I said, no, thank you. I'm not interested, you know, in that. But it is fascinating how people confuse these.
The New York people wanted, in other words, to be able to dump on Governor Christie without being seen to do so.
I don't think so. I think my own reading of it was that they didn't want to talk about it at all.
Oh, I see. I see. Oftentimes,
because, you know, when you're running something like the Port Authority of New York, there's a great deal of patronage. And it wasn't only Chris Christie who was participating in the governing of the Port Authority.
Mm. So, you know, you talk about trying to get the other side of a story. Here's something that happened down in Houston. A reporter for KTRK in Houston knocked on the door of a man who was accused of child sex abuse. And the guy who came to the door said, turn off the camera. And then he produced a gun. So, you know, when you're looking at a gun, you do turn off the camera.
At the very least. He didn't say turn off the camera. They turned off the camera, and just to get the sequence right. And then they produced the gun. No, he produced the gun on camera?
The man told the TV crew to turn off the camera, which they did not do. And that point, he pulls the gun.
Then he pulls the gun.
Now that's
so the TV station news director is saying, don't go knock on the door of crime suspects anymore. It's too big a risk to journalists today. So what do you think about this?
I just hate this. That's why I put it on the top
on
the the top of the stack to talk today. It's one more excuse that we give to not get the full story. And this is the anti-police side. It's just so wrong. I don't really think there's a danger. That camera went in there with that crew went in there with a camera blazing. That's what caused the problem. That's not even good journalism. How are you going to get somebody to talk to you if you're immediately in attack mode? That was the problem.
Well,
not that they knocked on the door.
Right.
Well, it depends, of course, what the real purpose of this was. So if the real purpose was to get information, you'd be right.
Correct.
If the real purpose was to beard the perp, the alleged perp, and, you know,
to get dramatic
look
of it, yeah,
and hold them guilty.
Make them look guilty.
Yeah,
that's, well, either way, then, I mean, I just see the behavior of the station as appalling in either case. If that were for an ambush attack, deplorable. And if they now are going to say no reporter can knock on the door if someone's suspected of a crime, it's just one-sided reporting.
Absolutely.
I just don't know how you defend
You have to knock on the door. I have been threatened. You know, I've had guys say to me when I'm with a photographer, you know, you shoot that picture, it'll be the last thing.
Common.
But you have to knock on the door. And I don't know of reporters who have been shot dead in this country in that circumstance.
There's another implication here now, too. The station is on record saying our policy is we don't knock on the doors. So say a reporter out of a sense of, fair play and professional practice, actually does knock on the door and something happens, the station is not legally liable for anything that happens. So no hospital bills are covered. If there's a trespassing charge, the station's not responsible.
Wow, you're thinking like a manager.
She was a manager.
I know. what a terrible thing.
I would like a lot of people to be talking about this. This policy needs to be reversed. It's awful.
Do you guys think that there's a difference? It's an interesting story between the way in which a print reporter goes about their job and the way in which a TV reporter goes about their job.
Hugely. Yes. You know, one of the great advantages of there are advantages either way, but one of the great advantages of being a print reporter is that you can be less visible. Your observation of events is not as obvious, and therefore you have an opportunity to more closely adhere to the truth. On the other hand, some people, I've actually been in a frustrating situation where somebody wouldn't talk to me, and then a TV camera comes up and they start I just want to strangle them. You know?
But the mission of the TV station, in terms of the core audience, is different, I think, you've often talked to Rex and Rosemary about the interpretive nature as we go forward when TV is instant and going online or doing the paper is less quick. So I knew a guy once, a manager who I knew, who got into a lot of trouble for trying to get a priest together with a kid, a pedophilia thing, and he got into terrible trouble.
You mean they wanted them each to tell their stories?
Yeah. No. They tried to set it up so that they would have a camera on the priest.
Oh, my.
Going after the kid. And he got into a lot of trouble. But that, other than to tell a sort of salacious story, is the idea that a television station manager might be more likely to do something like
yes, because the difficulty is, and I've been a TV reporter and producer, and the problem is you need visuals. That's hard. I mean, there are challenges to telling certain stories on television. And if you don't have the visuals, you can only, you know, people will not stand for more than about 15 seconds of words on television without visuals. And so you can't tell a complex story that way. No wonder they go for something like a recreation.
This wasn't the recreation. This is trying to set it up.
I don't know. I think TV now has some more options than they used to, including graphics, computer-generated images. Recreations, I don't have too much of a problem with as long as they are well-labeled. But, yeah, the kind of ambush journalism and the combative stuff, I hate it. And yet 60 Minutes was the one who really made those popular years ago.
Yeah, so it was very dramatic.
It hasn't gone away. Yeah, it's
good
TV. Yeah,
it was absolutely. And as a young journalism student, I remember camera rolling.
So I want to do that.
Yeah, let's go do this kind of stuff. But you actually, you know, you touch on something that's pretty interesting, as long as it's well labeled. And this is sort of one of the new issues in journalism, transparency. As long as you tell people what you're doing, you can almost get away with this. This is one of the things that's now being discussed in the Society of Professional Journalists, which is the national organization, used to be called Sigma Delta Chi, that oversees.
Which always says that you always do, before you say it, I'm going to do it because I'll puke if you say it, which is do no harm, you know.
Yeah. No, that's not medicine.
They don't do that
that's
anymore.
We say the opposite. We say minimize harm, but we don't say, because we recognize that reporting sometimes does harm. Can't avoid it. It's going to harm some people if you tell the truth.
No, I get it.
But now the new thing is that they're saying transparency is the key. Let people know what your reporting techniques are. And that sort of forgives all manner of sins. I'm not sure that's a good idea in drafting this new code of ethics. It seems to me that while that is great, transparency, and you know, we've often had conversations, Alan, about transparency. You think that journalists ought to explain their political affiliations and biases.
Well, biases, you know, I'm a fan of Judge Jerome Frank, who thought that every judge ought to be psychoanalyzed so that you would know whether they had prejudice or not. That's not going to happen, obviously, but that's the model. You know, the idea that everybody has a worldview. We've talked about that many times, the well-known Weltanschauung. And a reporter might harbor some things that other reporters don't.
But how do you reveal your psychological makeup? You know, how does it, if a reporter says, you know, my mama beat me up and therefore I'm hostile to women in my reporting?
Obviously you don't.
Uh-huh.
But it's a good point, intellectual point.
I want to set up this whole idea of a code better. Journalists are not like doctors who get a professional license. And one cost of that license is you ascribe to a code of ethics. It tells you how you may act. And if you violate the law, laws, you end up in a court.
So you're saying that Rex, is talking to you about setting up a code of ethics? You think that it's wrong for journalists
no,
to
No, I
do
don't
that?
Think it's wrong. I just want you to know the role of the SPJ code. It's a widely respected and debated set of guidelines. Mm. So it's not like a set of rules that if I don't do this, if I don't tell you what my biases are, you cannot take me to jail for it or sue me.
But that's so self-serving, what you just said.
What's self-serving?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because, you know, you say, well, doctors are professionals, and if they take out the wrong leg or do this, you know, they're doing harm, and that's very bad, and they could end up before the medical board and get their license taken away from them. Lawyers have some of the same stuff. But journalists don't, because this is just an advisory sort of thing.
Well, we don't have licensing in this country, do we?
But we don't make as much as doctors either, let me point out.
You guys have walked right into my trap, you see, because you can do just the same kind of harm that the doctors or lawyers can. And you say, but we don't have to worry about being held responsible the same way these other professionals are.
Actually, that's not true. In a legal sense, we cannot be held accountable in the same way. But we are a constitutionally protected field, and so we
Which makes ascribe, it even worse.
We ascribe voluntarily to a code of ethics. That's why
not everybody
what's
does.
In here, most people do. Right. All responsible people do. And that's why what's in this code from the SPJ is really important. So SPJ's point of view, which, by the way, does include be accountable for errors, one of them is they say, the code just says, don't engage in conflicts of interest. Just avoid them. And if you can, then disclose them. And they think that covers it all. So the opponents of the new code, which is in revision, it hasn't been revised since 1996, are saying, no, we have to disclose everything. SPJ drafters are saying, if you give people the permission to disclose, then they'll just do anything. It's okay to go off with half the information. It's okay to write about something you personally are enriching yourself from. It just opens up a whole lot of crimes.
Am I not explaining this?
Yeah, I think so. And one of the things that this is a result of is that there is now a rise of, let's say, overtly biased journalism.
Correct.
You know, we have a lot of...
Just read the New York Post, for God's sakes.
Well, yes, but even things that are intentionally and clearly opinion, which are still perceived as journalism. What are some good examples of this? You know, for example, Huffington Post is liberal, and so that while they do reporting, it has a left bias and so on. So that sort of thing, they're saying, has value. And even the folks at Pointer Institute, Alan, that we talk about here often.
Wonderful singing group.
It's actually just great. Are saying, you know, Kelly McBride, who is the head of their ethics program, and I've worked with Kelly on a number of things.
We know you have, Rex.
And I respect her highly, but I am not sure that I agree with this notion is advancing that we
that
should...
independence?
Yeah, that this... She says, we're moving to a model where not all of our news providers are politically independent. Do we as a profession declare that those voices are outside of the profession, or do we find a way to validate the good journalism that they do and carve out a space for them? I say we declare that that kind of journalism is not really as valid independent journalism.
Both of you, I just can't really follow this. What kind of journalism, again, are you speaking about?
Journalism that comes from a nonprofit organization, for example, Transparency International, will come out about a report on corruption in this country. We should not believe it because Transparency International is an anti-corruption organization. Or anything that Planned Parenthood puts out about women's health, we should not believe because they're for abortion. Right? That's the sort of thing. Kelly McBride is saying, well, those reports are still valuable and we should still acknowledge them. Rex is saying, well,
it's not journalism. It is interesting information. It's information to be useful, but I think that it's a different realm than the journalism of verification that we try to practice
every day. But let me ask you guys a question. If somebody writes a column for the New York Times or for anybody else, you know, the head of Planned Parenthood, and said, this is my opinion on this, is that journalism?
Yes, but it's clearly labeled as a column. I think the difficulty is when you have stuff that purports to be fact-based news reporting that is, in fact, from a biased point of view.
So we have to really sort of subdivide,
yes,
since you fell for my trap, all of the parts of journalism. We have to subdivide and say we have a set of ethical specifications for some journalists, but not for all, because we know that there are a whole bunch of different kinds of journalists.
No, that columnist, even if they had a decided point of view, like the president of Planned Parenthood, would not be allowed to write things that were blatantly untrue.
No, that's true.
Would not be allowed to, like, slam the head of the, you know, anti-abortion forces.
Yes, they could.
No, not without signing it, not without saying this is where the information came from. All the rules of the code would apply to that person as well. They would still be liable to the code.
One of the other things. Well, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just
We're confusing
sorry.
I feel like I'm in my media ethics class.
Yeah.
I'm so confused. Not. I just don't really understand why, you know, you guys continually say things that really aren't just exactly so. I mean, in other words, I see
now
opinion.
Now I know why we got that coffee, Rex.
I see opinion columns all the time. And one could say that's not true if you by somebody who takes one side or the other. They're not libelous. They just happen to be disputed.
What you see are columns that give an opinion in a good newspaper that practices, as Rex says, verification. You give all the sides. So one day you'll see a column saying, this is a point of view. The next day you'll see a column giving a different point of view. Mm-hmm. That's offering you the range of opinion.
Well, we do that here at Public
Radio. Sure, of course you do. It's the same. It's the exact same thing.
Right. It's one of the interesting elements, by the way, of this new code of ethics, just one more thing about it, is that it is for the first time acknowledging how much journalism has changed as a result of digital reporting. And it is saying, for example, aggressively update information as the story unfolds. And it is reflecting the fact that more and more of our journalism is almost a draft, that we're covering things minute by minute as opposed to pulling stuff together. We have it painted on our major conference room walls, the tenets of the SPJ Code of Ethics, seek the truth and report it fully. And I often say that our biggest ethical failure is that last phrase, report it fully. We fail to get the full nuance of a story, the shades of gray in which we lead our lives, as opposed to the easy black and white that you can gather from initial reports. But the fact of the matter is that a lot of the time in digital reporting, you don't have time to gather the shades of gray before
you have to be on air.
You have to be on the air.
Yeah,
you're
even to get the names right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And one of the things I love about some of these newspapers, like the Times, for example, is that inevitably there'll be another little paragraph after you read it digitally and say an earlier version of this said.
Correct.
And of course, one of the only things that troubles me about it is it's almost always that the name had an E at the end of it as opposed to major concepts. That's all.
But it's great. That is transparency, by the way, to tell you what was earlier there and what was wrong and what's been fixed. And, of course, online you can also have strike-throughs that will fix something, which is another way of being transparent, a good thing. Okay. By the way, if you want to share in this conversation, you can email us media@wamc.org. This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, I'm Rex Smith, and we're here with you weekly to talk about the issues that are going on in newspaper reporting. Sign of the Times. 5 years ago, the largest newspaper in the state of Alaska, the Anchorage Daily News, published a cute little skeptical Q&A with the editor of a startup news website called the Alaska Dispatch. Last week, the Alaska Dispatch, that little startup website, bought the Anchorage Daily News for $34 million.
Wow.
So how's that?
Yeah, I loved it. The Q&A raised the question of whether the Dispatch might be a hobby rather than an actual business. And now we're in the stage where print newspapering may be a hobby. I hate saying it. I'm choking on it.
Well, but for wealthy owners who are buying newspapers, like Jeff Bezos has bought the Washington Post, and
Warren Buffett plays at newspapers.
Warren and the Taylors have bought the Boston Globe again. It is something of a hobby, and it's a good thing when local people decide to invest in their local journalism to support it. We can appreciate that.
My father, who worked for the city of New York during the Lindsay administration, used to kid around and say to me, never kick a kid in knee pants on their way up because they may end up as your boss.
Yeah, absolutely. Finally today, there's an interesting essay written by a guy named John Reinert, who is in marketing, and he is a former journalist who, when he was a college student, spent a summer selling Electrolux vacuum cleaners door-to-door in Minneapolis. And he says that being in media relations, that is the term we use for FLAC.
FLAC or PR.
Yes, and we are hacks, I guess, by the same standard. Being a FLAC, it helps to have a little patter, like selling a vacuum cleaner.
Well, except that the analysis goes even further. If you think about it, you remember some of those vacuum cleaner people would throw the ashes on the floor and say, let me sweep it up for you. And there was a certain amount of compulsion involved in that. You want the stuff cleaned up, then, buy the vacuum cleaner.
Well, I don't think he would be opposed to cute little catches like that. My favorite of his comparisons between being a vacuum cleaner and a reporter's people can be jerks.
Yeah.
Sometimes the door is slammed on you and you're aggressively reminded that your very existence is an affront. You just have to shrug it off.
Exactly. You know, it is true that reporters can sometimes be a little bit tough on Flax. And some of them really deserve it.
Yes, they do.
We have.
But they are often powerful people because they control access to their principals sometimes. And so a lot of the reporters here at the Capitol in Albany, a lot of those reporters end up as Flax.
This is true. And they get paid a lot more to have the door slammed on them sometimes. Sure. All right. We're done. We're out of time.
Oh, boy.
Thanks for joining us for the Media Project.
Now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk.